In a highly breakable, often shakable world, it's good to know that some things never change.
When we are pressured to conform, when our beliefs are belittled, it's good to know that some things never change.
When we are asked to do the impossible and we fail, it's good to know some things never change.
When we feel all alone and we wonder if we should take a public stand, it's good to know some things never change.
When God tests us with success and we are tempted to take the credit for ourselves and nurture our pride, it's good to know that some things never change.
When everything around us seems uncertain and out of control, it's good to know that some things never change.
When events shake us to our core, when right seems wrong, and when wrong seems right, it's good to know that some things never change.
When pain and suffering put our faith to the test,
and the foundations we build upon seem like leaves in the wind,
it's good to know that there's a rock, there's a refuge, there's a promise, there's a goal. There's a Jesus who never changes.
When shaking times come,
it's good to know
that some things are unshakable.
Hey, welcome to Calvary. I love the opportunities I get every once in a while to meet some of those of you who I don't see every week at Harvest Field. So, man, shout out to Calvary Tyrone and Calvary Lewistown and Calvary Penns Valley. And those of you who kind of just connect online, Kathy and Dave and the Kellys and the Wallings out in California. Man, it's just good to know that there is a community that extends even beyond where we gather in physical places. So welcome to Calvary. However you found us and wherever you are so welcome. I just want to jump right in with a question. The question is this: what do you see? What do you see? Well, I see Dan in a sweater vest and a black shirt. Big surprise, right? Take it a bit farther. Look around. Maybe even right where you are. What do you see? Or think back. What sights have shaped your week? What do you see? I love this story. A woman was sitting in the waiting room for her first appointment with a new dentist, and she noticed his DDS diploma, which bore his full name. And as she read the name, she remembered this tall, handsome, dark-haired boy with the same name. He had been in her high school class so many years ago. Could this be the same guy, she's thinking, that I had a crush on way back then? But that thought quickly went out of her mind, flew out of her mind when she met the balding, gray-haired man with deep lines on his face. Huh, she thought, he's way too old to have been my classmate. But still, after he examined her teeth, she couldn't help but ask, did you happen to attend Morgan Park High School? Yeah, he said, a smile on his face. I'm a Mustang. When did you graduate, she asked. 1959, why do you ask? He replied, you were in my class, she exclaimed. Really? He said, looking closely at her. What did you teach? You see, it's not about how good you look. It's about how well you see. What do you see? How well do you see it? John Eldridge describes an experience he and his family endured in Alaska. They were in a plane running low on fuel. They had circled for what seemed an eternity, but still the fog refused to lift. Rain and mist covered the windshield of the plane as they all strained, he and his family strained to find a break in the clouds. Nobody wanted to leave, but running out of gas was not a very good option. The weather was rough and below them was the ocean. I mean, if they survived the crash, it'd last about 7 minutes in the icy water. 3 more minutes, the pilot yelled above the drone of the plane's engines. Then we'll have to turn back. We'll give it one more pass. He and his family had come to see Fairweather Mountain. Eldridge writes these words, Fairweather Mountain is totally misnamed. With a name like that, don't you picture some lovely place in Hawaii or maybe Costa Rica? Balmy breezes, gentle green slopes, the weather always, well, fair. No, these mountains explode 15,000 feet above sea level right off the coast of Alaska. Sheer cliffs and foreboding glaciers. Some of the world's worst weather hangs out here. The pilot was yelling. They get their name because you can only see them in fair weather. What idiot came up with that cleverness, Eldridge thought. They ought to be named the Peaks of Frozen Death or the Don't Even Think About It Mountains. Fair weather? Around here, that means maybe 20 days a year if you're lucky. Well, that day they got lucky. With minutes to spare, the clouds parted, and they had this breathtaking view of a lifetime. Vertical granite walls that rose and fell thousands of feet on either side. White cascades of ice falling through thin air 20 days a year, if you're lucky. Do you ever feel like when it comes to what you see, you're just not lucky? Like I'm living my life in a fog, 20 days a year, maybe I get clarity. So what I'm saying is that when it comes to reality, we all need to be reminded that there is more. In fact, say this to yourself, there's more than I can see. There's more than I can see. Isn't this what Paul was describing when he wrote in 2 Corinthians 4:18, so we don't look at the troubles. We don't fix our eyes on the troubles. We don't look at the troubles we can see now. Rather, we fix our gaze on things that cannot be seen. For the things we see now will soon be gone, but the things we cannot see will last forever. The things we see now will soon be gone, but there are unseen things that will last forever. In other words, some unseen things are unshakable. So what do you see? And do you believe there's more than you can see? And I'm not talking about conspiracy. Some of us have gotten really good at believing there's more than we can see. I'm not talking about worry or fear, believing that there's more bad stuff than will ever even happen. But we do it all the time, right? We believe in things that we don't see, even in science. Dark matter, dark energy. One publication said that the normal matter that we can see and measure and prove and feel and taste and touch, it makes up about 5% of the universe. If you know anything about particle physics, you know about the Higgs boson particle. For over a generation, scientists talked about and believed in this particle that no one had ever seen, measured, or even proven exist. And yet they believed it was so fundamental in shaping the universe that some scientists called it the God particle. There's more than we can see. In the last 30 months, I've had some variation of that thought over and over and over again. There's more here than we can see. As we've been going through what we've been going through, I thought, there's more here than we can see. What is God doing? I'm not talking about physics or QAnon. I'm talking about spiritual realities. I'm talking about heavenly places. I'm talking about the love of Jesus and God at work in our world. I'm talking about the resurrection power of the Spirit of God in our church, in our schools, our neighborhoods, and our workplaces. There's more than we can see. Maybe one of the reasons why we find ourselves in such a struggle today. Think about this. Is this true for you? With so many different things, so many different struggles, it's because at least when it comes to God's stuff, we've come to believe that what we can see is all there is to see. But what if there's more? What if Paul is right? That what's unseen is actually more real than what's seen. I think that sounds a little bit like crazy talk. When what is unseen is more real to you than what is seen, it's like, I don't know, you may have a problem. You might need medication. But what if what is unseen is not always unreal? What if sometimes unshakable is also unseen? So I think this is the truth that the writer of Hebrews is digging out in Hebrews chapter 11. Before the chapter we've been looking at, we call that the faith chapter. In verses 1 through 3 of Hebrews 11, he writes, faith shows the reality of what we hope for it is the evidence of things we cannot see. Through their faith, the people in days of old earned a good reputation. By faith, we understand that the entire universe was formed at God's command, that what we now see did not come from anything that can be seen. Faith is the evidence of unseen, unshakable realities and truths. Faith is the evidence of unseen, unshakable realities and truths. Now, maybe you're thinking, exactly, and I don't believe. I can't believe that stuff. I don't have faith, so there is no evidence of unseen realities. But listen to me, I'm not talking about your faith. I'm not talking about your lack of faith. The writer of Hebrews doesn't know whether you have faith or not. In fact, it's quite likely that he's writing to people who, just like you, just like me, we wrestle with doubt and worry and fear. Some of us can't seem to hang on to faith. See, I think he's talking about the faith of the people contained in Hebrews 11. By faith, Moses did this and Esther did that. By faith, Sarah accepted this and Joshua did that. Their faith is evidence that there's more. Fatima lives in Iran. Iran has the fastest growing church globally in the world today. Her earliest memories include being raped by her brothers. At 11, she was sold in marriage to a young drug addict who abused her and then divorced her when she was 17. Returning home, she was raped repeatedly until she decided to leave. And now, no home, on the streets, she heard the gospel for the first time. She heard the gospel preached, and she trusted in Jesus. In time, she married a Christian man. They trained in evangelism and church planting. And just that, listen, that would be enough for me to believe there's more. Just her faith to that point. And yet even there's more. Fatima felt called to go back home, to forgive her family, witness to her family. Her entire family repented and gave their lives to Jesus. The very first church that Fatima and her husband planted was in her childhood home. Her faith is evidence that there's more than I can see. What do you see? I mean, just do a little bit of an imagination exercise with me. Just close your eyes right now, and unless you're driving or something as you listen, and just close your eyes and imagine your front door. You're inside your home, wherever you live, and you go to the front door, you reach down, you turn the knob, and you walk out into your hallway or your front yard or the street, and you look around to the left, to the right, across the street, across the hall. Now let me ask you, what do you unsee? Well, what are you missing? Ask yourself, what are the unseen realities around you, in your neighborhood, in your workplace, in your school, where you shop? Can I tell you three things that often go unseen in our daily life? Things that we don't see that are so very, very real. Number one, we don't see the brokenness, right? In part, we don't see the brokenness because we don't want to see the brokenness because it hurts. We don't see the brokenness around us. Number two, we don't see the beauty, the potential for glory that's sometimes hidden deep within every person created in the image of God, loved by Jesus, a soul of great worth and value. And so number three, because we miss the beauty and the brokenness, we often miss God at work, because that's where he works. Well, what do you see? Do you believe there's actually more than you can see, that unseen spiritual realities impact our lives and the lives of those around us, and that those unseen realities are actually more real, more unshakable than the shakable seen? Now, Hebrews chapter 12 is, as you read it, it's either just a metaphor for life. It's symbolic. It's symbolism with all its talk of races and crowds cheering us on, or it's a treasure map for the unseen realities that are unshakable. And I think you know what I think. I think there's more than we can see. And Hebrews chapter 12 describes the more. He describes the reality behind the curtain. In verses 18 through 24, the more being described is two mountains. Now, just to set the context, let me tell you what I believe. I believe there's only two mountains. In fact, I think that's part of the message here. We want there to be more mountains. We want to choose among the many choices the mountain whose heights we desire to climb. And I want what I want to pursue as I climb my mountain. But listen to me, there are only two mountains. There's no political power or most popular mountain. There's no king of the mountain. There's no comfort and security and stuff mountain. There's just two mountains. The first mountain is described in Hebrews chapter 12. Verses 18 through 21. And here's what it says. You have not come to a physical mountain, to a place of flaming fire, darkness, gloom, and whirlwind, as the Israelites did at Mount Sinai. For they heard an awesome trumpet blast and a voice so terrible, they begged God to stop speaking. They staggered back under God's command. If even an animal touches the mountain, this mountain, it must be stoned to death. Moses himself was so frightened, it says, at the sight that he said, I am terrified and trembling. Now, this is the mountain where the people of Israel first encountered God, Mount Sinai, the mountain of God on the far side of the wilderness. And after they were delivered from Egypt in the midst of plagues and curses and the angel of death, this is the mountain where they came. This is the mountain where Moses gathered the Ten Commandments, the rules for following God. This is the mountain where the people were so afraid of God, they said to Moses, you talk to God and tell us what he says, because if we talk to God, we'll die. This is a mountain where God's voice staggers us. It's a mountain of darkness and gloom and fear. This is not your mountain. This is the mountain of God before the cross of Christ. This is trying hard and failing often and never measuring up. This is the mountain of God's great disappointment, where God promises his power but not his presence, because he won't give himself to us as we are. But this is not your mountain. Listen, this is not your mountain. Not if you believe in Jesus. Not if you have surrendered your life to Jesus. Not if you have experienced God's grace and his heart opened up by the gift of Christ on another mountain. If you've done that, this is not your mountain. Can I say it again? This is not your mountain. This is not your mountain. This is the mountain where you know what it takes to gain God's love, and you know that you can't gain God's love. This is the mountain where you are so conflicted because you don't want to go back, but you can't see the way forward. But this is not your mountain. If the unshakable Jesus has your life, this is not your mountain. And there's far too many of us who are living like this is our mountain. But it's not your mountain. Listen to Hebrews 12, 22 through 24. The writer says, no, this is not your mountain. No, you have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to countless thousands of angels in a joyful gathering. You have come to the assembly of God's firstborn children, whose names are written in heaven. You've come to God himself, who is the judge over all things. You've come to the spirits of the righteous ones in heaven, who have now been made perfect. You've come to Jesus. You've come to Jesus, the one who mediates the new covenant between God and people, and to the sprinkled blood of Jesus, which speaks of forgiveness instead of crying out for vengeance. Did you hear that? You have come. It doesn't say one day you'll come. It doesn't say you're in the process of coming. It doesn't say, I'm not sure that you're going to make it. I hope you find your way. It says you have come. You're here. You've come to a joyful gathering in the midst of worship already begun. This is your mountain. This is your home, this joyful gathering. When you feel like your life is filled with dark alleys and never-ending pits of gloom, and even when all you can see around you is a barren wilderness, I'm telling you, there's more than you can see. You've come to the city of our living God, where light is like the air we breathe and joy grows on trees. You've come to a city where worship never sleeps. When we worship, we never start it. We enter it. We join in. It's all around us. It's always, always, always going. The angels can't stop enjoying God. I've been thinking about this a lot lately, especially with the last few encounter nights of worship that we've had at Calvary Harvest Fields. And if you haven't joined us, you should come. It's so good. You see, worship is simply the fulfillment of joy. It's like a good meal is not finished until we praise the cook. A good joy is not finished until we praise the creator. Joy unstopping leads to worship that is unending. And this is your mountain. You've come to this mountain. When it's hard to worship because joy seems out of reach, this is still your mountain. The holy hallelujahs resound even if your heart can't hear them. This is still your mountain. The angels who threw a party when you came to this mountain will teach us the songs of heaven. Holy, 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 worthy is the Lamb who was slain. This is your mountain. You've come to this mountain. You've come home to the family of God. You're not just a number. You have a name. You've come to the assembly, it says. You've come to the assembly of God's firstborn kids. Do you know why it would matter in those days that you're more than just God's kid? You're his firstborn. And it's an assembly of firstborn, more than one firstborn. How do you do that? You see, the firstborn was the heir. Everything the father has belongs to the firstborn. And so the writers are simply saying, we're co-heirs. We're all of us. We're co-heirs with Christ. Everything that the father has belongs to you. You've come to the mountain of your inheritance. And listen, it makes the Powerball look like a common dirty penny. Your name is in the book. You're not just a number. You're firstborn, part of the family. During this last season of life, some words that Paul wrote in Ephesians 1, I've quoted them many times in a lot of different messages. They've given me some great encouragement. I like how it reads in the New Living Translation. It says, long ago, before God made the world, God chose us to be his very own. He decided then to make us holy in his eyes. And so without a single fault, we stand before him covered in his love. His unchanging plan has always been to adopt us into his own family by sending Jesus Christ to die for us. And he did this. I love this. He did this because he wanted to. Didn't have to. You're not the have to of God. You're the want to. I mean, ponder that. Long ago, before the most grand and awesome of any part of God's creation was even a gleam in Father God's eye, God loved you and he chose you. He fashioned your heart with his heart as a model. The warrior poet David tells us that as he formed you in your mother's womb, he dreamed dreams about your life. He looked forward to all your days. It's been his unchanging plan to adopt you into his own family by sending Jesus to die for you. And he did this because he wanted to. He wanted to. He wanted to. I mean, let that settle in. You are covered in his love. God is so for you. This is the mountain to which you have come. You are relentlessly loved with a lavish affection. So would you just let God love you? Nobody knows you better. He knows everything you've ever done and everything that's been done to you. And still he says, come. He knows every secret place and every shameful moment. And still he says, come. With your broken hearts and your doubts, with your distractions and your anger, with all your failures and lusts and wrong desires, he says, come. The Apostle John exclaims, see what great love the Father has lavished on us that we should be his kids. Do you understand? You're not just another broken mom who needs help. You're his daughter. You're not a disappointment. You're his son. You have a forever family. This is your mountain. You've come to this mountain. You've come to Jesus, the overflowing grace of Jesus, our mediator who made a way for us to come. I love the story that Philip Yancey tells of coming home. He tells the story of a young girl who grows up in a cherry orchard near Traverse City, Michigan. Her parents can't understand her. Her nose ring, the music she listens to, the length of her skirts, and so they struggle. She wants freedom. They want limits. She wants loud. They want soft. She wants late. They want early. One night, emotions are boiling. I hate you, she screams at her father, and that night, she acts on a plan she's mentally rehearsed scores of times, and she runs away from home. She'd been to Detroit once with her church youth group to watch the Tigers play, and she figures it's the last place her parents will look. The second day there, she meets a guy who drives the biggest car she's ever seen. He offers her a ride, buys her lunch, gives her a place to stay and some pills to make the stay more pleasurable. Before long, she's part of his escort service. Underage men pay a premium for her. She lives in a penthouse and orders room service. And sometimes her thoughts travel back home, but she'll never go back. A year later, when the first pale signs of sickness appear, it's amazing how quickly the boss turns mean. Can't mess around these days, and before she knows it, she's out on the street without a penny to her name. Winter blows in, and she's sleeping on the metal grates outside big department stores. Dark bands circle her eyes. Her cough gets worse. Life is not safe, and one night as she lies awake listening for footsteps, she realizes how alone she is. Like a little child again, lost, scared, belonging to no one, she begins to cry. She wants to go home. She pulls her legs tight underneath her and shivers under the papers that she's pulled over her coat. And suddenly this single image fills her mind. It's May in Traverse City when a million cherry trees bloom at once with her golden retriever dashing through the rows of trees chasing a tennis ball. And now she's sobbing. More than anything else in the world, she just wants to go home. Three phone calls, three no answers. Two times she clicks the red button without leaving a message. But the third time she says, Dad, Mom, it's me. And I'm just wondering about coming home. I'm catching a bus up your way. It'll get there about midnight tomorrow. If you're not there, I guess I'll just stay on the bus till Canada. It's a 7-hour bus ride from Detroit to Traverse City, a long time to imagine why going home won't work. She wonders if they'll even come, what they'll say. And she practices her speech, right? Dad, I'm sorry. I know I was wrong. It's not your fault. Dad, can you forgive me? As the bus rolls into the station, the driver announces, 15 minutes, folks. That's all we have here. 15 minutes to decide her life. She checks herself in her mirror, smooths her hair, looks at the tobacco stains on her fingertips, and walks into the terminal, not knowing what to expect, but never once has she ever considered that she might see something more. There in the concrete walls and plastic chairs, bus terminal in Traverse City, Michigan, stands a group of 40 brothers, sisters, great-aunts and uncles, cousins, a grandmother and a great-grandmother to boot. They're all wearing ridiculous-looking party hats and blowing noisemakers. And taped across the entire wall of the terminal is a computer-generated banner that reads, "Welcome Home." Her dad breaks from the crowd. She can hardly see through her tears, and she can hardly speak through the lump in her throat. "Dad, I'm sorry," she starts. He interrupts her. "Shh, we got no time for that. You'll be late for the party at home." Do you understand? This is your mountain. You've come to this mountain. You've come. You're here. It's not just your final destination. It's your current unshakable address. The writer of Hebrews describes two mountains. There's a mountain where God's voice staggers us to our knees. It's a mountain of darkness, gloom, and fear, a mountain where the best among us tremble. But there's also a mountain called Zion, the city of our living God. It's a mountain of endless joy where worship never stops because worship is just the overflow of joy. It's the mountain where the family of God dives into the endless grace of Jesus. It's the mountain where the least among us are relentlessly loved. But there's only two mountains. We want there to be more. We want to choose among many choices the mountain whose heights we desire to climb, but there are only two mountains. To which mountain have you come? Upon which mountain have you fixed your eyes? Which one shapes all that you see? Because that mountain is not merely our eternal destiny, it's our current address. That's why the writer of Hebrews says in verse 25, so see to it. See to it. Hebrews 12:25, see to it that you do not refuse him who speaks. Because whoever gets your ears shapes your heart. And whoever shapes your heart shapes your destiny. And there's only two mountains. And if we can get our ears away from the distractions of voices that matter so little, you can hear his whisper, "Come home, child. Come home." In January of 2000, leaders of Charlotte, North Carolina, invited their favorite son, Billy Graham. You know that name. Even if you never knew who he was, you know that name. They invited him to a luncheon, and Billy initially said no because he had Parkinson's disease. But the Charlotte leader said, we don't expect a major address from you. Just come and let us honor you. And so he agreed. And after he was honored, Billy Graham came to the front, and he looked at the crowd, and he said, I'm reminded today of a story told by Albert Einstein. Einstein was traveling from Princeton on a train when the conductor came down the aisle punching the tickets. And when he came to Einstein, Albert reached in his vest pocket, but he couldn't find his ticket. And he checked all his pockets and his briefcase and the seat around him, but he couldn't find his ticket. And the conductor finally said, "Dr. Einstein, I know who you are. We all know who you are. I'm sure you bought a ticket. Don't worry about it." Einstein nodded appreciatively. The conductor continued down the aisle, but before he went to the next car, he turned around and he saw the great physicist down on his hands and knees, looking under the seat for his ticket. He rushed back. He said, "Dr. Einstein, don't worry. I know who you are. No problem. You don't need a ticket." Einstein looked at him and said, "Young man, I too know who I am. What I don't know is where I'm going." Graham continued. He said, "See this suit I'm wearing? It's a brand new suit. My wife and my daughter have told me that I don't look so good anymore. And so I went out and I bought a new suit for today and for one more day." He said, "You see, this is the suit in which I'll be buried. But when you hear that I've died, I hope you don't remember my suit. What I hope you remember is this. I know who I am, but I also know where I'm going." See, Billy Graham knew where he was going because he had been living there most of his life. He had come to that mountain, even though it was unseen. That's where he lived. That was his address. Which mountain have you come to? Have you come home? And if not, would you like to? If you would, I want to give you a silent moment to simply pray these two things, to say, Jesus, I believe in you, and I surrender my life to you. Jesus, I believe in you, and I surrender my life to you. It's that simple. I receive your forgiveness. I believe you died for me, and I surrender my life to you. And if you said those two things in your heart, in your mind, God hears, and you've now come to this mountain. And I'd like you to pray, maybe for the very first time as a follower of Jesus, this unshakable prayer. It's on the screen. I'm just going to ask you to say it along with me as we close. God, my life is not unshakable, but you are. Come and shake everything that can be shaken, so that only what's unshakable remains. God, shake every little kingdom so that the whole world knows that only Christ is King. God, shake us till our communities are full of your glory, and shake me till people can only see Jesus in me. We've come to Zion, the mountain of endless joy. We've come to the unshakable city of God to dive into grace. I trust your relentless, unshakable love with all my doubts and failures, all my shame and pride. I come home. May my eyes be captivated by your unshakable kingdom. May your voice shape my heart. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.